I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food. I'm really excited because I have with me two people from a very beautiful, lovely, love-filled place that I've actually been to in Costa Rica, Lands in Love. And I have Rona Stein and Nama Aryan. Yes? Very good. Welcome. How are you both doing?
Thank you.
Yeah, we're doing good. It's a lovely day today here.
Yeah. It's a beautiful day. Your space is beautiful. I will never forget it. And I think it's grown quite a bit since I've been there because I don't remember you having a sanctuary when I was there. So can you tell me about that?
If you were here in the real beginning, it was starting.
That okay.
Frame. We came here with intention.
We didn't came with intention to have a sanctuary. We came from Israel 16 years ago with our pets, and our goal was to have an animal-friendly zone, to be vegetarian or vegan, and show people that you don't have to eat animals in order to have a lovely,
now,
fulfilling food.
It sounds like some of your animals want to be a part of this conversation.
Yes, they are.
Just around there.
I think my listeners like to hear that kind of noise. It's real.
We have 450 of this noise now in our place.
450?
Yeah, of this noise. We have 350 of others and others and others. We have 1,000 animals in total.
Wow. Okay, first, let me know why you started. You all came from Israel, about 18 of you, I think?
We're 16.
16.
16 friends. We are friends
for ages.
Many years, and we had a dream to live together, and as I said, to have an animal-friendly place. And in Israel, it was difficult to open a place, so we start looking around the world. And to make a long story short, we found ourselves in Costa Rica. We came here with all of our pets from Israel, which back then were 50 cats and 25 dogs or something like this. All of them are not with us anymore out of
age, definitely.
Yeah.
But the last one died just a little while ago. He died at the age of 22 or something like that.
Right. Now, in addition to dogs and cats, you have a sanctuary, and what other kinds of animals can we find there?
The real sanctuary is the dogs and cats. I mean, we mend dogs and cats that come here usually ill, molested, injured, and they live here and they all get the best medical attention, the best food, whatever they need. And some I even cook for in the kitchen. Other animals are fun, but we obviously take good care of them as well. And that's horses, sheep. We have 200 hens, and we have, yes, geese and ducks.
We have geese running all over the main road, and rabbits, and hamsters, and all kinds of ducks and things like this we have over there too.
Yeah, it's a beautiful place and a beautiful area. It's near the volcano, right?
On the way from the capital city, San Jose, to La Fortuna, the volcano.
Which is one of those tourist sites people like to go to. I have not been there. I didn't stop at Lands in Love to go anywhere else. I went to you to be at your place.
Very good.
I agree.
We're all going through a very unique time, somewhat unique for humanity. There have been other plagues and pandemics, but I don't think anyone in this lifetime has experienced what we're going through right now, and it's affecting the entire world, and it's affecting Costa Rica, I know that. So why don't you let us know how it's affecting you?
I will start telling you that our place and our animals were funded by a tour operator, by this hotel, but also since you were here, we have established a big tour operator. It was a very hectic one, and brought into Costa Rica in the high season about 40 groups a month, many FITs all year long. So that was funded the animals.
Well, all the income from the hotel and the tour operator business that we had were supported the rescue center, because during the years we've had more and more and more animals. People were keep on throwing animals here and abandoning them here. We have more and more animals, and all the incomes are going directly to the animals, feeding them, medical care and everything. And one day all the tourists stopped. No flights, no tourism, no income, nothing. And all the savings and everything that we had already ran out. So now we're looking for donations and people who love animals and want to assist animals to assist us to keep on going and taking care of all the animals.
Where can people find you if they want to know more about you and support you?
Oh, we have a website of the sanctuary. We have Instagram page and Facebook page that you can follow up with stories and telling of the everyday life here, of special treatments or newcomers, 5 kittens in a box 5 days ago, or a dog after a car accident 2 days ago, and all things like this. So they can follow and see what we do and be a part of it, even if they cannot come here directly.
Okay, I'll include links to your sites on my page.
And a part of that, we need donations, and we would love at the moment that people can fly in. Also, all kinds of volunteers can help, just people that love animals and also people that are professional. That will save us some of the money. We pay a whole lot of money to vet here.
And starting November 1st, Costa Rica is open to countries from all over the world. Just you need to do a corona test before you come, but all the countries can come here. So if and when people will start traveling again, if they will know about this place and come and visit, enjoy this place.
I've recommended it many times and I will continue to do so.
And they can also organize their whole trip through us, from the flight and on, even the flight tickets, everything. We at the beginning, at the moment the tourism will come back, our tour operator that is known to be very good will continue working, and we do all the work.
How many guests can you accommodate at Lands in Love?
Depends if it's families or couples. We have 38 rooms.
38 rooms.
And in, for instance, for Passover, we have over 100 people that stay in the hotel and do the very beautiful Passover.
Beautiful.
Usually there's one side of the lobby that celebrates Christmas and people open presents. Other side that they light the candle of Hanukkah. It's very international, very nice.
I love the country of Costa Rica, and I hope that you're happy that you chose to settle there.
We do. It is a beautiful country, and so much to see, and so much nature, and green all over when you go, and the beaches and the mountains, and amazing country.
So you were just telling me before we started that you were vegetarian when you started this place, and now you've gone vegan. Have all of you, or some of you? What's happened? All of us. How did that happen?
We always thought that we do the best for animals at the moment that we don't kill them and eat them. But then we found out what many people don't know, that the milk and the eggs, all these are harming animals.
Just as you think when you grow up and you eat a tuna, you think it comes from a can in the supermarket. And when you eat a hamburger, you think it goes, something frozen in the supermarket. And then you grow and you start to think and know that it comes from an animal. So we stopped eating that. And then there's more knowledge that in order to have eggs and dairy, you also make animals suffer. So we stopped that too.
Well, I'm very happy to hear this, which makes me love your place even more.
And our menu for vegans, it's like we have...
Nobody believes.
It's
a whole book.
So, yeah, it's a book, so many things, such a variety.
That's wonderful. Yeah. I can't wait. I can't wait to come back.
We're so wait for you to come back.
Now, you probably know this, but Israel, your home country, has become very vegan friendly in the last few years. No. Incredible.
It's amazing. When you go to Israel, I've been there 2 years ago visiting my family. You go to a coffee place or a restaurant, and it's a regular thing to have a vegan mark next to a vegan dishes. You don't need to ask. You don't need to be special. You're not a weirdo, and it's normal. And this is so fun.
It's every place. No place, not every.
So I'm assuming, or let me know, the people that come to stay at Lands in Love, are most of them from outside of Costa Rica, or do you have locals coming too?
We have locals coming too, obviously, especially at this time when there are no tourists from other countries. It's also very rewarding to us to see that they eat the vegetarian and vegan food and they like it. Mm-hmm. And for us, this is one of the missions that we had when we started this place, to show people that they can eat food that does not come from animals and it's tasty and it's fulfilling.
Yes.
And you don't have to feel like you didn't eat anything afterwards, all the stigma that people had on vegan food.
Do most of the locals who stay with you know what they're getting, or they're surprised?
They know what they're getting when they come. They're not
okay.
But sometimes they are, depends.
They're curious.
The thing is that it's food and it's also the area. You know, everywhere in the world now, when you go to places, you have to be all masked and all very, it's like very crazy. And when you come to here, like I say to everybody, it's not a yellow zone, it's not a purple zone, it's a green zone. You just walk, you don't have to wear a mask when you walk in the forest. And that's why local people would come here lately, because they have a different atmosphere than the city.
That's nice. Now, can you give me just an idea of what vegan items you serve on the menu? Is it Israeli style, Costa Rica style? Is it a bit of everything? What do you have?
We have, first of all, a very big variety of breakfast. And all the bread, you know, normal breakfasts you get, American breakfast, Israeli breakfast, and morning burrito. Everywhere that there's usually an egg, there would be a chickpea omelette or a scrambled or tofu. We treat it like shakshuka, if you know it's shakshuka with tofu and everything. Then in the main dishes, there is a big Israeli section. There's a big Asian chef section with all the pad thai and sushi and Chinese and Cantonese rice. Then there is a Mexican, very good Mexican food, burrito, taco. We also have a lot of stuff that is gluten-free. As we are part of being vegan, we're also big gluten-free out of choice. So people that have to eat gluten-free also find themselves with a big menu and a big variety. Then there's also obviously sweets, because you can't do it no sweets.
Making vegan chocolate.
Lovely.
I make cakes and desserts of it. And then we have great shakes. Everyone that passes here and have a vegan shake dies.
Okay, I'm getting very hungry. Back to the point of this conversation, other than letting people know about this wonderful place, but about the sanctuary and about your needs, because there are how many hundreds of animals right now?
We have 300 cats and about 450 dogs, in addition to the horses and ducks and all the things that we say, sheep and rabbits
and
all the other animals that we have.
And you need help.
Yes. We really need help. We are very...
We take care of them from all of our hearts. You know, we give them such love and care. This is our purpose, goal. This is what we wanted to do. This is what got us all together. And maybe it's selfish to say, but we do quite a good job at it.
Taking care of everyone.
Each has a name. Each has his own personality. I personally take care of 200 cats. I know everyone by name, by nature, by personality, by disease, by special things that they like to do. We really, really do it with lots of love, and all of our hearts goes into it, into the animals, into taking care of it. So it's the animals. It's our life project. It's our souls. It's their souls. It's their well-being. So for us, it's everything.
As they come here, many of them come ill or after injuries, the need of a veterinary, of a vet is big. And we take them, we don't think twice. When an animal needs a medical care, we take them to medical care.
It's a no-killing shelter. So we take care of them until the end.
And for us, it's very frustrating to think that this thing might end, or the animals would not be taken care as well as we take care of them.
Well, I am going to share your story with everyone that I know.
Thank you very much.
I sincerely hope to visit very soon.
We hope so too, and we hope more people will come and see this place, and we hope that people all over the world are taking care of their animals and not deserting them just because of these hard times, probably financially hard for everyone.
Okay. Shalom.
Shalom. And thank you.
And Nama.
Thank you very much. Yeah.
Okay. Take care. Thanks for taking the time to speak with me.
Thank you so much for your
support. Okay. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Don't you love that? When we can talk to people around the world. I just really appreciate the opportunity to speak with Nama and Rona from Lands in Love. And now I have another guest, Jeff Miller.
He is an associate professor of hospitality management at Colorado State University. He is the co-author of Food Studies, An Introduction to Research Methods, and was named Culinary Educator of the Year in 2017. We're here to talk about one of the edible series books with reaction books called Avocado, A Global History. And I can't wait to bite into this. Thanks for joining me, Jeff.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate being here.
I read your book and I really enjoyed it. It's a lovely story. It has a lot of interesting information. And so many of us love the avocado that it was just wonderful reading about it. There are some good stories. There are some scary stories.
Yeah.
And just like any food, I love to say that every food has its story. And the avocado is a fascinating one. So let's just dive in. I've made a few notes. I'm just wondering, why did Reaction Books choose you to write about the avocado?
I was at the Oxford Symposium on Food and Drink a few years ago, and we were having dinner. And the series editor is an old friend of mine, Andy Smith. And I was eating with him and Michael Lehman, who's the publisher of Reaction Books. And Michael just said kind of offhandedly, you know, the avocado is an interesting topic. I don't know how we got on it. He said, that's interesting. Somebody should do a book on it. And he was already had published a number of these. And so I went back to Colorado after the symposium was over and cobbled together a proposal and sent it off, and it was accepted.
Very nice. And I hope you've enjoyed the journey.
It was an interesting topic to write about. I, like most people, I had eaten avocados for years and, you know, I knew a little bit about how to pick a good one and a bad one, but I really knew very little about them until I started researching the book. And, you know, as we say a lot in academia, you never really learn as much about something until you teach it. So it's kind of the same thing here. I learned a lot on the journey and it was quite interesting.
Yes, I agree with you. Okay, so let's start by talking about the avocado seed and how it works or doesn't work. So a lot of us like to take a seed and put it in a little bit of water and grow a little tree. Yeah. And if we had the right climate and put it in the ground, we may not get what we expected to get.
That's right. Avocados are pretty fecund. They will grow pretty well. But they're also what is known as heterozygous, which means if you plant the seed of an avocado tree, the chances of it being just like the avocado you got the seed from are virtually nil. So you could get something that's horrible and practically inedible. You might get something fantastic. You might get something that's better than the avocado you get in the grocery store, but it's a total crapshoot. And avocados are not unique this way. Apples are famously the same as well. So if you plant a seed from an apple tree, are you going to get what they call an eater or a spitter?
And how does that work? This has something to do with grafting. Can you explain what that is?
Right. So if you want to get an avocado tree that's just like the avocado that you're eating, you need to go where that tree was, cut off a branch, graft it to some rootstock, and then let that tree grow, and that will become true to the brand. So essentially, it's a clone. And, you know, all the Hass avocados that we eat today are clones of the original mother tree in La Habra, California.
Wow. So I imagine that could be a good thing and maybe not such a good thing.
You know, the good thing is that we know exactly what will come off of that tree, and growers and marketers love that. If something ever happens to destroy, you know, some virus or some fungus or some bug comes along to destroy that particular avocado tree, we'll be backpedaling pretty hard to fill that market share that's now filled by the Hass avocado.
Yes. And that's where that word diversity comes in one more time.
That's right.
everybody's talking about diversity, and diversity matters on every level. It matters with people. It matters with the food we grow. It matters with how we grow. We need diversity if we want to survive and live well.
Yes, we do. Absolutely. Biodiversity is critical in plant agriculture.
Yeah, but people like to know they're getting what they expect.
Yes.
Yeah. It's an interesting thing because we really, the species, the planet thrive on diversity, but a lot of us just like to get comfortable with the same old, same old. Okay, let's continue with this seed because you talked about how the seed was really designed for another time, a prehistoric time. Can you explain that? With the megafauna that used to live on this planet. That was like fascinating.
Yeah, at the end of the Pleistocene and the earth was littered, so to speak, with these megafauna. And a lot of them were what we call mega herbivores. So you have animals as much as twice as big as a modern African elephant wandering the earth and living only on vegetables. And so you think about how much hay and food an African elephant eats every day, which is an astounding amount of food, and then double that, and then you have the earth populated with these things. They're eating a lot of vegetation, and as we know, it takes a lot of grass and a lot of leaves to make a few calories. And so here's this plant that offers fat, offers a lot of calories, actually has an odor designed to attract these animals, and they're huge. And so they would just go up to an avocado tree and pull one off the ground and just swallow it whole. And it's interesting that the pit of an avocado has just a little bit of a chemical that's just slightly toxic. But what it does is it protects it and causes the pit to pass through this animal really quick. And so you have this whole pit that hasn't been chewed up. You know, it's gone through the digestive system really quickly, so it's not damaged. And it's deposited on the ground in a convenient pile of, let's call it fertilizer.
We can call it poop. We can call it shit. We can call it anything on this program. We're progressive.
It's got its own pile of fertilizer. It's just an ideal method for, it's a really great strategy for a plant to reproduce itself. Yeah. We don't think about plants having strategies, but this is really a great strategy for a plant to broaden its range and to reproduce itself.
Well, you say those animals ate the avocado whole. I hope they got to appreciate that wonderful flavor a little bit on the way down.
Well, they mostly swallowed it whole. And also avocados of that period had much less flesh. They had a much higher seed to flesh ratio. One of the things that we've done through humans doing plant and animal selection is we always breed for more meat, right? And we've done the same thing with the avocado as well. So modern avocado is very different than the avocado that was going around being eaten by the toxodons and the giant armadillos and the ground sloths.
So what's fascinating is so many of us knew nothing about the avocado for so long. I grew up, in New York, I never had an avocado. I think the first avocado I had, I don't remember, but I think it was when I moved to California in the early 80s. I don't think I had avocado before then. And now it's just ubiquitous. Everyone loves the avocado and we're all complaining because it's more expensive, but we'll get to that in a little bit. I love the history. I was smiling because you talked about the California roll, the Japanese sushi maki, and it has crab and avocado in it. And you talked about how it wasn't created in California. It was actually created in British Columbia. And my connecting the dots to all of this, which doesn't really mean anything, but it does to me, is that I lived in the Bay Area in the 80s, the early 90s, and the Japanese had a big presence there in Silicon Valley at the time. There were a lot of Japanese restaurants. I would eat at them, and I never really got interested in the food. And then I went to Vancouver, the Canadian Vancouver, and I had avocado maki. I'm a vegan, so avocado maki was good for me. And it was just amazing. I thought this was the most amazing combination of flavors, just perfection. And I still do. And it's just interesting that they specialized a little bit in that area.
It's an interesting product that goes well with sushi, being the sushi rice, being starchy and and sweet with a little vinegar, and then you know have that mouth coating fattiness of the avocado. It's a good combination, and it was originally used in sushi to replace really expensive tuna belly, which is also very fatty and creamy. So somebody said, "Oh, I can't afford, tuna belly. What can I substitute for it?" And what they came up with was probably wildly more popular than anything they'd have served with tuna belly in when it was created in the 70s.
You mentioned, and this put a little light of concern up for me. You mentioned that there's a company called Appeal Sciences, and they have this plant-based film that they spray on avocados to slow the ripening process. And I'm always concerned when I hear about people spraying my apples and putting things on it. Can you talk about that coating, and should we be concerned about it? Is it on organic produce, do you know, or not?
And I don't know how many producers are using it. Most of the avocados get bought and then, consolidated into some major wholesalers. And I don't know which ones are and which one aren't. The two things, I'm not too concerned about it personally. The two things are, it's plant-based, it's a cellulose-based product. So it's made from the waste products of agricultural production. So is it organic? Hard to say, probably not, considering the multitude of sources that they're sourcing for the scraps. But avocado rind is really thick. I don't know. I just don't think it's probably a big issue in terms of food safety. It's such a thin coating. It's microns thin coating of a product. It's probably relatively benign on a very thick rind. So I think if you, and none of us eat avocado rind. So it's not something I would probably be particularly worried about. If you want to be worried about other aspects of avocado consumption, we can talk about that, but that's probably one that I think is relatively benign.
Good. Okay. Well, I was just curious to read about it. Just something else I didn't know. And I always like to learn new things. And then I was kind of laughing, but it's a serious issue apparently, that people don't know how to cut an avocado correctly, and you get what's called avocado hand.
Well, the most famous victim is Meryl Streep. She was at an opening of an Apple store in New York City and showed the audience her hand where she cut it. And so, she, like most of us, was holding it in her hand probably and cutting little slices. And if you have a really sharp knife, I said that avocado rind is thick, but it's not that thick. So that knife can easily slip through there. So, food safety people and public health people very seriously put out. The British actually have a whole warning that they've posted about, put the avocado on the counter and, slice it on the counter and be really careful, because we do see people coming in to the emergency rooms nearly every day with cut hands from slicing avocados in their hands.
Okay, everybody, I hope you appreciate that tip.
That's right.
I use a cutting board. I put the avocado on a cutting board. I slice it in half. I knock the pit with the knife and pull it out. And then I scoop it out with a spoon. And then I slice it on the board.
I try to be good. I'm a trained chef, so I tell myself that I'm better than the average person on the street when it comes to slicing avocados, but I know I'll get my comeuppance someday.
Let's get to some serious issues regarding avocado. It's a delicious food. So many of us love it and use it in so many different ways, but it has its dark side, unfortunately. I was talking to Tom Philpott last week. He has a book out called Perilous Bounty, and we were talking about farming agriculture, specifically in California, and the issue with water is really frightening, not only in terms of droughts and fires, which we're seeing right now, but also a potential big flood that's supposed to be coming in the next 20 years. So avocado is one of those big water suckers.
Yes. In California, we talk about almond production, and we use almonds kind of as the poster child for extravagant water use. But that avocado that you have on your cutting board has taken about a bathtub full of water to produce. When you grow it in sub-Saharan Africa where there's plenty of rainfall, or you grow it in Michoacan where it's from, where there's enough natural rainfall, that's not a big issue. When you grow it, in certain parts of California that require lots of irrigation, probably even worse is how much irrigation it takes to grow them in Australia, where they're also very popular, and there's a big avocado industry. You divert a lot of water to avocado production. Water is definitely one of the issues. In fact, in California, I hear, this is somewhat anecdotal, but I hear that actually some people are taking their avocado orchards out and replacing them with strawberry fields because they're a little less resource intensive, both for water, but also for labor. You know, you still kind of almost have to go pick avocados by hand, more or less. And so it's a lot of labor to get that. That's why an avocado still costs a dollar.
Wow, it costs more than a dollar. It costs about $2 in New York.
Okay.
Sometimes we don't get them. Now, in addition to water, there are other issues. Of course, there's agricultural chemicals, and they're wreaking havoc, especially on the farmers and their families. But can we talk about Mexico and the cartels that are involved with growing avocado? This is the most horrific, I think, of the avocado story.
Yeah, and I always like to kind of give the caveat before I talk about this. This is not every avocado field, not every avocado producer, not every avocado operation down there. It's a problem that waxes and wanes. So I like to kind of give this caveat, but there is a lot of narco traficante cartel participation in the avocado industry. And you just have to know that as an avocado eater. Like I say, the seriousness or the depth or the breadth or however you want to describe it of the problem kind of waxes and wanes depending on other issues. The cartels got into it initially because there was such a hard crackdown on illegal drug movement activity down there, cocaine and marijuana and methamphetamine. So during one of these periodic crackdowns, they decided to get into a little bit of extortion based on the avocado business, which was booming down there. And so now there's definitely some participation by the narcotraffic cartels in the avocado business. They extort money from growers. They extort money from pickers unions. Probably, you know, what I think's the most troubling, you know, as an American is that there are a lot of American companies, oh, no, I don't say a lot. There are some American companies down there that are part owners in packing houses and agglomerators down there. And there's a suspicion that American companies are paying off the narco cartels, are paying the extortion, just like the locals down there and the local companies. So, you know, as an American, that's disturbing to me. So, you know, I just, like I said, it's not every company, it's not every farmer, but if you think about all the avocados that you buy over the course of a year and where they possibly, you know, because they're sourced from so many places, you're pretty much inevitably putting a little bit of money in the pocket of the narcotraficantes. Your better bets are organic avocados because they tend to be from smaller producers, you know, and also there's some good ecological reasons we could talk about. They tend to be smaller producers, and with crime, like everything else, scale is important. And so they tend not to be extorted as much or as heavily. So if you had to go looking for something just for a political crime reason, I would consider looking for organic avocados from Mexico. But that's just one of the problems inherent with eating an avocado from time to time.
That's just one more reason to me why bigger is not always better.
Yes, exactly. I was just doing some work in that area this morning. And you know, scale, economy of scale can be good, but, you know, it's also, it obfuscates a lot of problems.
Do you know, are there any organizations that are following this that we might look for information or updates on avocados?
I could send you a little information about, you could post.
Great. Okay.
I just don't have those names and websites in my head right now, but there's definitely some people who are following this. There are some people who are doing some work in sustainable avocado production where they're doing polycultures that involve avocados and pigs and a whole cycle of, you know, feeding unusable avocados to pigs to fatten the pigs, and the pig manure fertilizes the tree. And it's a nice tight system in there. So, but I can send some information that you can post.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Well. All right. One more thing I think I wanted to mention is the issue with monarch butterflies and how they're connected to avocados. We all love monarch butterflies. They kind of represent this innocent, beautiful part of nature that we're so often disconnected from.
Right. Yeah, they're valuable members of the ecological community, and they're you have to admire them. They're these things that look so fragile and beautiful and delicate, yet they migrate thousands of miles. You know, I lived in Kansas City area for a long time, and it was on a monarch migration path, and to see a whole hedgerow full of shimmering monarchs was just a sight of nature that would bring tears to your eyes. It was so beautiful. But they really need the Oyamel fir forest in central Mexico for overwintering and breeding purposes. And it's critical they go down there every winter and overwinter there, and then they can come back and do all the marvelous things they do for us up here during the warm season here. But these Oyamel fir forests thrive in exactly the same places that avocados thrive in Michoacán, Oaxaca, and that part of south central Mexico. And because avocados are so valuable, you know, they're called green gold down in, you know, in certain parts of Mexico, oro verde, because they're so valuable. And they've done, you know, they've done a lot of really great things to bring, you know, campesinos into the middle class and stuff. So it's a complex issue, but they're so valuable that people are illegally encroaching on the reserves and cutting down the Oyamel firs, which monarchs depend on, to plant avocado orchards. And so, because, you know, they're so lucrative and people down there need money, but the Mexican government has a very hard time enforcing ecological regulations down there. And to be quite frank, there's people in the government there who consider economic development for the locals more important than preserving the butterflies for us.
Not the only government that does that.
Well, yeah, it's certainly, they get encouragement from other governments, that's for sure. But if you look at, you could go to World Wildlife Fund and look at the charts, you can see that the popularity of avocados and the decline of the monarch butter population, they just go hand in hand. It's hard to make, you know, it's correlative, it's not causal, but it's hard to make any other conclusion when you look at statistics like that. What else? And you know, there's not an increase in the use of pesticides. We're not putting up nets at the border and catching them. What else could explain this mass? You know, if somebody's got a better explanation, I would like to hear it.
In addition, Mexico is, you wrote, the largest producer of avocados, and they used to be the leader in consuming avocados, but they're not anymore. This is a story we've heard a lot about a number of different foods. Sure. And they become popular in a certain country and then they export them. They become too expensive for the locals to consume them.
Yeah. Now, as we see this, like the story with quinoa and so many things that
quinoa,
we've seen.
Exactly. In Bolivia.
You know, it's great. It's, you know, it's a dense source of calories. It's fairly healthy. It's a great food source for people in central Mexico, especially. But they've become so valuable to export. They can get more for an export avocado at a whole, you know, we would consider a very low wholesale price, and then get for a retail in the market there. So, you know, for the people who want dollars, who want to make money from export, it makes much more sense to send them here. We take most, when I say we, the United States, we take most of the avocados that come out of Mexico. So it makes more sense if you want to make money to send them up here and send them to us rather than sell them on the local market. And it takes quite a bit of a daily minimum wage in Mexico to buy avocados now. So in the areas where they grow pretty well, there are a lot of smallholders still have an avocado tree in the yard. And so they haven't disappeared, but for the urban worker, especially who doesn't make very much money, may not have a place to grow any food, a food source that provides a lot of energy dense calories that's no longer available to them.
So should we be trying to consume avocados that just come from the United States if we live here in the U.S.?
Well, I mean, I hate to be prescriptive about other people's behaviors. I can tell you what I do, and you can kind of cue your own behavior from there, but two things happened while I was writing this book is I found out all this information about avocados, which kind of soured me a little bit on them. I still enjoy avocados, although not as much as I used to. And partly it's I had to test those recipes over and over again in the back of the book. And by the time I'd done all that, it's kind of off avocados for a while anyhow. But I try and buy American avocados. If in my store, you know, they're available, I don't know, maybe 4 months a year. So I try and buy American. I'll be honest, I occasionally buy Mexican avocado, but I don't very much anymore. And so I look for organic avocados whenever I can. You know, they do spray some pretty terrible stuff around avocado orchards in this country and in Mexico and anywhere in the world, really, that they grow them. But I've cut way back on my consumption of them, generally speaking. You know, possibly it's over familiarity from writing the book. But so that's my thing. I look for American avocados when I can. I look for organic avocados always. And I just eat less of them. I think sometimes it's okay to think about things as a seasonal treat, a seasonal fare. You know, one of the things that has happened, and you've probably had many guests on your show talk about, you know, we've gotten away from seasonality as a concept in food. And, you know, we think that it's our right to have, I live in Colorado, and we think it's our right to have strawberries in January in Colorado. Maybe we need to think about, we eat avocados for 3 or 4 months a year when, you know, definitely, from September to December when they're in season, and then we give them up the rest of the
definitely time. Well, we're going to have to change. Either we're going to do it voluntarily or the climate is going to make us change.
Yeah, climate change is going to affect avocados, that's for sure.
It's affecting strawberries, all food. It's going to affect everything. Stay tuned.
I think we're going to have to eat a lot more rutabagas. Thank goodness I like rutabagas.
Rutabagas. Okay, I like them too. They're good in soup.
They're great in everything. I think it's the most underappreciated vegetable on the planet.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to give some credit to the artwork in the book. Not sure if you were involved with that at all, but I really enjoyed looking at some of the drawings, as well as some of the old posters, the agricultural posters from the early 1900s. Oh, yeah. I love those. And there was also a picture of a chocolate cake with avocado buttercream. And when I looked in the back, I noticed it was from the Vegan Feast Catering. So I'm assuming it was a vegan cake, which made me very excited.
Yeah.
But it looked so good.
You know, for a long time, especially in colonial era Mexico, avocados were known as poor man's butter. And they were used as, it was used as a butter substitute for a lot of things. And so makes a lot of sense. You could put it in a cake and use it for butter, use it for buttercream frosting, assuming you like green buttercream frosting.
I've seen it used in so many wonderful recipes, and you have a few in the back of the book. I love the avocado. I will try and do my part and eat more seasonally and locally with the avocado along with everything else, because it just makes more sense. And I think I might enjoy the avocado even more than I do now.
Yeah, I think, you know, you give it a break for a little while, you come back and you really appreciate how much you love it. And I know the avocado is ubiquitous today, and I'm not, you know, I don't flatter myself that I'm going to change a lot of people's behaviors, but I hope getting the word out there helps a little bit. And, you know, it's, as I say in the book, it's kind of a unicorn food. Everybody thinks it's like the ideal food.
I used to think, you know, when people think, what would the one food be that you would take on a deserted island if there was only one thing? And for a while, it was the avocado. But I've passed on that. Now, for me, it's the garbanzo bean.
You know, it's interesting. I'm kind of in a garbanzo fiend phase myself right now.
It's
like really great.
So great. So satisfying. So versatile. I mean, if you're on a deserted island, you may not be able to do all the things that I do with the garbanzo bean now. But that would be my choice. Anyway, so there is a book from Edible Series on beans. I haven't read it yet, but I don't know if they focus on the garbanzo bean specifically. But
you should read that one, because the author maybe knows more about beans than anybody in the world. And he's an incredibly charming man and very fun to talk to.
Yeah, I have my copy, so I'm looking forward to reading it.
Yeah.
All right, Jeff Miller, thank you for taking the time to talk to me on It's All About Food. Loved your book, Avocado Global History. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me. Go out and have some guacamole.
Okay, ole. Thank you.
All right, thank you.
That was Jeff Miller, the author of Avocado, A Global History. Earlier, I spoke with Rona Stein and Nama Arian from The Hotel Lands in Love. And in Spanish, that's Tierras Enamoradas, an environmental and animal-friendly zone, 280 acres for an eco resort located in a hidden valley in the middle of a cloud forest, beautiful as a legend. Welcome, Gary DiMattei, back to It's All About Food.
Speaking of legends, welcome, Gary DiMattei. I like that introduction. So let me ask you a question. What is a cloud forest? It sounds great, but what is a cloud forest?
You know, that's a really good question. There's a lot of moisture in the air.
Oh. It sounds like a place that
you go. It sounds magical, right?
That's magical.
Right? I've been there.
Is it magical?
And I want you to go there with me.
Oh, let's go.
Yes, and we can go soon because New York has been allowed to go to Costa Rica for the last month or so.
Sure, us New Yorkers can go, but not the rest of the U.S., right?
And November 1st, anyone can go to Costa Rica. They're opening up their borders because it's a very important tourist time in Costa Rica. November to about February is when the weather is just perfection.
So we have to go.
Let's go to Lands and Love.
Yeah, and we have to give some money to Lands and Love because they're trying to raise money because they are not only a resort, they are also, as I just learned, a rescue center for animals.
Yeah, and I want to ask everybody if you are able to visit landsandlove.com and visit their rescue center page, animallove.cr. CR for Costa Rica, obviously. They need help. They're doing wonderful things. And I know there are so many people and animals that need help, especially during this time of the coronavirus. But this is one more organization that needs help, and I think they're very deserving. As you could tell, listening to Rona Stein and Nama Arian, they are genuine people, full of love.
And they are just two of 16 folks who originally left Israel and went to Costa Rica to start this resort and rescue center. Is
yes,
that not
that's correct? Right. And they all came with the same passionate mission to have this animal-friendly zone and just create a beautiful space.
And they don't exterminate any of the animals.
That's right. It's a no-kill rescue center. They take the animals to veterinarians when necessary, when they've been hurt, when they're sick. And they're just very sincere. And as we just heard in the interview, they said that they were living on their savings.
Right.
And now they're out.
Right.
They really need help. Anybody that can help, $5, $10, $60, they're trying to raise a lot of money. It's a very unique space in the middle of Costa Rica to have these Israelis there and have them be vegetarian and now vegan.
Hey, maybe we could all meet there.
Let's all go together. They have 38 rooms.
38.
And depending on how they're used, they can hold a lot of people.
Fantastic. Now let's talk about what I'm really, really excited to talk about in addition to Lands and Love. Let's talk about the avocado.
Yeah.
Because I'm a huge fan of the avocado.
We learned the beautiful side of the avocado, the dark side of the avocado.
Oh, I don't like it when avocados are dark. I like it when they're nice and green. I didn't realize there was also a dark side of the avocado.
So the bottom line is, and I hope that we can do this, is eat avocados from California and from Florida. I like those fruitier, juicier ones from Florida, but from the United States, and eat them when they're in season. And then
that makes sense.
We really don't need to have them from anywhere else when they're not in season.
And would you also add to that, eat them organic?
Absolutely. Well, yeah. We learned another reason why we should eat them organic, because Jeff Miller believes that most of the organic farms in Mexico are small, and therefore the cartels that are terrorizing farmers from time to time in Mexico avoid the smaller farms. They go for the bang, the big size farms. So the organic farms tend to be smaller and are likely not terrorized. But
okay,
if we're going to purchase organic avocados in season from the United States,
you're going to need to dig into your pocket change for those, I tell you.
They're expensive.
They're expensive. But hey, you're not buying anything but wonderful food, not only for your body, but for our world. That's just making the world a better place, right?
It's funny because...
So it's worth the investment.
He said that they were once called a poor man's butter in Mexico.
Ah.
And they are not for poor men today.
Not for poor anybody.
Not for poor anybody. They're expensive.
Yeah, but you know, I talked about how I don't like the dark when an avocado gets dark. But you know how you can how you can clean that up a little.
No.
Squeeze a little lemon juice on it, or lime juice.
Right.
That brightens it back up again.
That's true, and just stir it.
Because what's on my mind right now is eating avocados.
Of course.
I like all kinds of things with avocados. And you're a big fan of using avocado in cooking avocados.
You know what I learned?
Hmm.
That from this book, that the reason why avocados aren't cooked is because they get bitter.
Right.
But I love the flavor of avocado when it's warm. So I guess when I reheat a burrito or something leftovers and it gets a little warm, or if I put it in a soup just at the last minute and it gets warm, I love that flavor.
You've never really cooked with it.
That's what I'm realizing, because right. Apparently it's not a good thing to do, and that's why it answered the question I was always asking myself in my head, why don't people cook with avocado? Because I love the flavor, but I love the flavor of a not that cooked avocado.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yes. And you know what else makes sense is, because avocados are, especially if you're purchasing organic avocados, what makes sense is that you feature them at the meal as a main course. Like a lot of things now are featured, like avocado toast is a major deal, right?
Mm-hmm.
You can just go into a restaurant. Well, some people can go into a restaurant and order avocado toast as an entree. I mean, guacamole was just something you put on top of, as you just mentioned, your burrito or your taco or your beans and rice. And it was like a little
aside,
not
a main
garnish. But now it's actually...
Except whenever we would order guacamole in a restaurant, it was never enough.
It was our main course. Yeah.
It was never enough.
No. And I love guacamole. I mean, what's your favorite guacamole recipe? Just very simple, right?
I like it with cilantro, red onion, tomatoes, a little lemon.
Right.
That's about it.
That's it. And some people like to add something spicy, hot, like chili peppers or
something.
Yeah. But I like it simple like that too. If not red onion, I like to add scallions to it.
Yeah.
And it's really good.
Avocados are really good. Gary, you're Italian.
Yes, I am.
Is there any avocado heritage in Italy?
You know, I was looking up that and I was wondering. Avocados don't sell that well. They're not as popular, I should say, in Italy as they are in other parts of the world. But they do grow them in the southern parts of Italy, like Sardinia and Sicily, those areas where the climate is perfect for avocados.
I was horrified when I lived in France in the early 90s. I don't know if what they're doing with avocados today, because that was a long time ago, but they would put mayonnaise on top of the avocado.
Yeah, a lot of folks like to do
that. Fat on fat. Why do we do that?
I don't know. I think they like to put a dressing on
it. Oh, gosh.
It's weird.
Yes, that was gross. Mayonnaise. Just mayonnaise. Right
mayonnaise
on top of avocado.
On top of the avocado. Yeah. You know, it was first introduced, apparently, in Italy on the Italian Riviera. So that was like back in 1909 or something like that.
The avocado has not been around very long.
Yeah, so they are there. They do grow them there, but they're not as popular as they are in other parts of the world. And what I was fascinated with that you were telling me about with the book that you just read, Jeff Miller's book, is that they actually do a frosting for cakes and things of that nature with the avocado, right?
Well, there was a picture of one in the book, and that's a vegan thing.
Right.
Using avocado. Well, not just vegan. And he mentioned some of this in the book. The avocado is used in smoothies.
Right.
And in lattes sometimes. And in ice creams. And chocolate mousse.
Really? An avocado latte?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
Because it's just creamy, fatty.
That's amazing. Yeah. Well, it's safe to say that I love avocados.
Gary loves avocados, everybody. And you grew up with them in California.
Oh, absolutely. There was a lot of avocados in California.
And there still are.
There still are.
That's most of them in the United States.
You know, the thing about that is I had a lot of friends who had avocado trees in their yards, and they were referred to by the parents as a nuisance because they were just dropping hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of avocados in the driveway, and they had to keep sweeping them up.
Oh my goodness, gold.
And now I can't even believe that they swept them up and they put them in the lawn trimmings barrel.
Oh, that's a crime.
And tossed them.
A crime.
Can you imagine?
No, I don't even want to think about it.
Here's my point. Avocados can be frozen if you make things like guacamole first and then put them in an airtight container and put them in your freezer. So don't throw your avocados away.
Right.
Freeze them after making guacamole.
Or send them to Responsible Eating and Living Pandemic Headquarters.
And we'll make the guacamole and freeze it and tell you how wonderful it was.
That's right. Now, you know, we didn't talk about Costa Rica, but they grow avocados there too. They're not one of the top producers, but they make a lot of avocados.
I've had avocados in Costa Rica, and then the very large avocados. They are not the Haas avocados. And you talked a lot about the difference between Haas avocados and the other avocados.
Well, there's
right?
a lot of varieties, but the Haas is the one that's taken over because it's so rich and so creamy. But the Florida avocados, the real big ones, I like them, and I think about them like I think about chocolate and carob, which we've talked about recently.
Right.
Carob is not chocolate and should not be confused as chocolate. It's a lovely fruit with a lovely flavor. And when you dry it and make a powder of it, it happens to look like cocoa powder. But it doesn't taste like cocoa powder. And it just shouldn't be mixed up. And I think about some other types of avocados. And in their own right, they all have their benefits. So that big, fruity, juicy Florida avocado.
Is that also the kind of avocado that's in Costa Rica?
Well, they have different varieties, but they have something similar. I don't know if it's the same.
See how we segue Costa Rica and avocados together again? We're back to Costa Rica.
Somebody did that intentionally.
Yeah. Anyway, I cut you off. You were saying about the avocado.
The Florida avocado is lighter, juicier, fruitier, and really lovely if you're not expecting a Haas avocado.
Wow.
It's just lovely in its own individuality. Give the Florida avocado a chance.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's beautiful. I've had some, but I love the way you explained it. You know there's a song about guacamole?
No, you want to sing it?
It's called the Guacamole Song. I don't know it, but I just looked up songs about avocados and
there's a guacamole song.
There's a guacamole song. Let's see if I can actually play a little bit of it.
Okay, that would be fun.
Peel the avocado, peel the avocado. Guac, guac, guacamole, guacamole. Anyway, that's the guacamole song.
That's cool. We're going to have to add that to one of our swinging gourmet shows.
Yeah. It's by Dr. Gene, and it's called the guacamole song.
Peel the avocado.
Guac, guacamole.
Everybody.
Peel the avocado. Guacamole.
That's a lot of fun, and we'll have to dig a little more into songs about avocado.
Or not.
Or not.
But hey, two great interviews today. A lot of wonderful information.
Gary, let's wrap this up.
Hey, it's good to wrap it up.
It is good.
Let's wrap it up like we wrap up a burrito with some avocado.
Avocado.
Yeah.
In season only.
In season only from the United States, if you can.
Thank you, everybody, for listening. And please don't forget, Lands in Love. Look at the links on the page for this program, and I hope you can help them out a little bit.
Yes. Thank you so much.
Thank you for joining me today.
Karen, thanks so much for talking avocados with me.
Everybody, thanks for listening. And
have a delicious week.